the second hour of Shattering Myths. We are in the midst of discussing what is the most problematic, certainly one of, if not the most problematic, passages in the whole of the so-called Christian New Testament. Reminding you that Christian means drugged in Greek, is not the title that should be applied to anyone, much less the Messiah, and that the testament of God, his covenant, has not yet been renewed, and it will never be new. So everything that even we use to label this book and the testimony contained into it is bogus, as is the term gospel when applied to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Those weren't their names. And gospel is a pagan term, meaning God's spell. Beyond all of that, if Christians were rational, they would recognize that the passage as it is presented in Mark and as it is presented in the book now known as Matthew, if it said that not even the Son knows the time that the Son of Man will return, then you are in a catch-22. Either your scriptural testimony, which you think is the Word of God, is unreliable, therefore you don't know what he actually said, or the person that you think was God wasn't. You lose either way. So this is a really important place to focus. Beyond that, and I think even more important than that realization, is that this passage alone is sufficient to disprove the religion of Christianity, because it either means the scripture is unreliable, or it's what it calls scripture is unreliable, or its so-called God is unreliable. But beyond that, it is a passage which causes people to say, there's no reason to know, there's no reason to observe, there's no reason to consider, there's no reason to think, because we can't know, we can't understand. And therefore, if we can't know and can't understand, then all we have is belief and faith. So it is the ultimate divide between religion and reason. So as Larry hinted at, the first thing we're going to talk about as it relates to this particular passage is, if we retain the not even the Son reference, Yahusha was neither divine nor Yahweh, making him a complete fraud, as it would be impossible for the Word made flesh to be unaware of the Word, or for the human manifestation of God not to know Yahweh's thoughts or testimony. Further, as an eternal being, there can't be a date that Yahusha doesn't know. God has defined himself as light. As light, he is able to see the past, the present, and the future all instantaneously. While he was talking with his disciples, he knew everything that was going to transpire throughout the rest of human history, as well as everything that had occurred in all of human history. Moreover, Yahweh told us what day he was going to return in the very chapter, in the very discussion in Zechariah that he had been citing up to this point. As God, he was present during creation. As God, he has already witnessed our future. In fact, in this very discussion, in the Olivet Discourse, by citing Zechariah, he told us precisely what was going to happen prior to and immediately prior to his return, accurately predicting the world war, the onslaught of terrorism, the prevailing nature of myths, and what would become a Torahless world, and of course the geometric increase in the frequency and intensity of storms and earthquakes that led us to this discussion in the first place. He got all of that right. And now you're going to say, even though he knows everything that's going to transpire right up to the point of his return, when it comes to his return, he's stupid? It's so absurd for him not to know what he just predicted. Therefore, I'm going to discard this interpretation and blame those who copyedited Yahweh's testimony for the not even the Son edition found in very late Mark manuscripts. After all, current scholarship confirms there are over 300,000 known variations and alterations between the Textus Receptus and older codexes, and there is the overt tendency by Christian scribes to reconcile contradictions. When one passage says includes something and another doesn't, their tendency is to make them say the same thing. And they make the choice as to which they're going to include. This known, the Greek as we have it today, actually reads, not the messengers, the agelos, of heaven, Aronos, if not the Son. So he is actually Yahusha, if, you know, he didn't speak Greek, so we have to be careful here. But if you read the Greek actually as it exists, Yahusha, being translated through all these various languages, is who is a heavenly messenger, is actually excluding himself from those who do not know, which, if he spoke Greek, would resolve the problem. You know, this means that the problem, therefore, is in translation, not in the testimony. That is what is inferred here by not the messengers of heaven, if not the Son. Now, the second option. So that's the first. The first is, if you include not even the Son, then you're dead. There's no way to resolve it, other than just issues with translation, but even there you have a problem because he didn't speak Greek. So, if you include it, he's not God. This whole thing is a waste of time. If you exclude it, you're on solid ground to do so. The second option, one predicated upon the removal or changing the rendering of not even the Son, requires us to assume that Yahusha's messengers, Yahweh's messengers, if you will, who are eternal spirits and thus able to experience time differently than we do, have no interest in knowing the timing of the most important event in human history. They're a blank slate when it comes to it. But since I've never met an angel, nor been told anything about their thought process, I suppose that's possible. They are tools, after all. A tool does not know how it's going to be deployed until it is being deployed. Yet, keep this in mind. Yahusha says in this very same passage that the messengers will announce his arrival. So even if they were completely unaware, they will be told in advance so that they will be able to fulfill their mission. This then means that perhaps we ought to be focusing on tenses, recognizing that there is no past, present, or future tense in Hebrew, and thus in the cited passage, but that these tenses now give us a problem in the Greek, particularly as we transition from Greek to English. Because obviously, according to Yahusha, the messengers have to know because they announce his arrival before he arrives. So it can't be that they will never know. Follow me on that?
Absolutely.
Okay. So, let's move on. Along these lines, the everyone, including the messengers, is the fact that they are and they will continue to be ignorant, requires us to make Yahusha's statement open-ended. That is to say, no one will ever know. But you can't do that. You can't make it open-ended, because the moment you make it open-ended, you contradict what he said next, which is that those very messengers who did not know currently, that they would never know, because that's impossible, because they know in advance of his arrival, because they announce it. So you can't extrapolate, no one will ever know from this. It's irrational in context. But if this is the case, it requires them, just take the irrational position, take this statement out of context so that the messengers aren't being called to in advance to announce his presence. If that's the case, it requires us to question why God would provide stunning mountains of detail specific to his plan, which we have been considering in Yirmiyahu and in Zechariah, and his timeline, and yet not want us to understand any of it? Why would God answer the question of when he's going to return, Yom Kippurim, and think that no one's going to even want to know when he's going to return? So, if we take that approach, then we have to take the approach that God gave us all of this information. He taught us all of his Torah, prophets, and Psalms for no reason. Because he's essentially saying that you're just too stupid to ever consider this evidence. You're too apathetic to consider the evidence, too stupid to think about it. You'll never figure it out, no matter how obvious I make it. Do you think that God's saying, you know, to the universe, you are so stupid, you are so worthless, you are so thoughtless, that even if I give you all of the clues that you need to figure it out, that you'll never be able to do so?
No, I don't think that. I think there was a day called the unknown day. That was Teruah. It was always called the unknown day. The return day was never called the unknown day.
Yeah, now we'll get to that in a moment. But we have to be careful there. Well, I think it's kind of an interesting play on words as it relates to the Greek. I don't think that that he cited this statement in Greek. So we're going to have to be careful with that next one, but we're going to get to that. The you know, this universal human ignorance and apathy is the only means to come up with this idea that God would give us all of this information and think that know that no one would ever bother to put the pieces together. And since we have, and since others have, obviously it's untrue. Now, our third alternative is so obvious, the first modern theologian to consider its implications within the context of God's timeline, whose name was John Mill, in 1707 accurately concluded that the verb oida, no one knows, in Matanyah 24:36 was rendered in the present tense. Problem solved, at least in the Greek. So, Yahusha was not saying that no one has ever known. He wasn't saying that no one would ever recognize the day, but only that no one at that specific moment in time, in that audience, was aware of it. That's all he was saying. Nothing more than that. And if you extrapolate it to today, and you cite it as if that present tense statement applies to the present tense today, then you're making the present tense future tense, and you have no reason or justification in doing so. I am Yada. This is Shattering Myths. To Shattering Myths. I am your host, Yada. You can engage in this discussion by calling 1-877-300-7645. What we have come to realize is the same thing that John Mill came to realize nearly several hundred years ago, and published this fact, not that it ever influenced Christians, that Yahusha did not, first of all, did not speak Greek, but what we have in the translation does not say that no one would ever know. It does not say that no one has ever known. It just said that at that specific moment in the present tense that no one was aware of the time. That's kind of like you go back in time and George Washington is sitting there and talking to his generals in the midst of the Revolutionary War and telling his generals, you know, no one knows the outcome of this war. That would be a true statement. But if you took that in forward and said, well, according to George Washington, no one knows the outcome of the Revolutionary War, that would be stupid. Just as it would be stupid for George Washington to say, no one will ever know the outcome of this war. He didn't say that, just like Yahusha didn't say, no one will ever know the day that I'm going to return. So this completely resolves the issue in Greek, and thus in English, if the English is translated correctly. There is no issue, of course, with the Hebrew, so it's not an issue that even has to be resolved in the Hebrew. Because the Hebrew reads, it was, it is, and it always will be, Haya. It exists as the one, the exclusive, the unique, the certain, and the explicit day whereby it was, it is, and always will be known from who yada, to approach Yahweh. And so in the Hebrew, you don't have a problem with the tenses. It's what he actually read in Hebrew is eternally true. This was, it is, it always will be the one and only day whereby it is known, has been known, is known, will always be known to approach Yahweh, Yom Kippurim.
Yada, can I add something
sure.
here?
Uh-huh. Just, yeah.
There are people out there, you know, with their Aramaic Basuras and their other
yes.
Aramaic gimmick books.
Mm-hmm.
And what,
mm-hmm.
what they do not, and all these same corruptions exist in them. As a matter mm-hmm. of fact, they all have the same exact canon as a Bible.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, as one of the things that needs to be pointed out here is that all the Aramaic books out there
mm-hmm.
that their New Testament section in them
mm-hmm.
are just copies from already corrupted material out of the Vulgate and the Textus Receptus and so forth.
Yeah, yeah. May I ask you a question?
They didn't find all these Aramaic scripts laying around. They've never been found. Am I correct?
Yeah, see, yeah, Larry's dealing with the front lines on this, and people will try to justify this by saying you shouldn't be looking at the Greek, you should look at the Aramaic, and therefore in the Aramaic you go back to the same problem. But here's the problem with the Aramaic translations. The oldest of them is from the 6th century. So the oldest of them is older than there are thousands upon thousands upon thousands of Greek manuscripts that predate the oldest Aramaic manuscript. It's like there are people who are writing books now about Hebrew manuscripts of Matanyah, of Matthew. And you ask them, what is the date of those manuscripts? And they're all, the 1100s, the 1200s, 1300s, that time frame doesn't do you any good. By that time, the Hebrew is a translation of the Greek, and by that time, the Aramaic was a translation of the Greek. It is a waste of time. It's like trying to translate the Hebrew scriptures from the Septuagint. Why would you go from Hebrew to Greek back into Hebrew? It is an absolute waste of time. Now, it is worth noting that that not only did John Mill close the case on the close-mindedness of the Christian knee-jerk response that we need belief and faith because knowing and understanding are impossible, he continued his investigations, and by doing so, it prompted him to question the veracity of the Textus Receptus, which was the basis of the Reformation, if you will. He found, just in his study, 30,000 errors in the university-accepted yet overwhelmingly flawed document, which still underlies the most all Bible translations. 30,000 discrepancies between the manuscripts that he had that predated the Textus Receptus and the Textus Receptus. And now we know that there are over 300,000 known variants between them. What he proved was the so-called Christian New Testament isn't remotely reliable. But more on this subject and even of the Greek word oida when we return to Shattering Myths after the break. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Yada. You can engage in this discussion by calling 877-300-7645. Before we move on to an analysis of Oida, I hear the weakest of three words in Greek for to convey the concept of no. I'd like just to pause a moment and reinforce something that's very important if you're a former Christian or if you are a Christian listening to this program. There are over 300,000 known variants between the oldest manuscripts of these Greek eyewitness accounts and the manuscripts that comprise the so-called Christian New Testament and the basis of your English translations today. There's only 182,000 words. There are 300,000 known variants. No two manuscripts agree. They're all different. It is impossible for all of these manuscripts to be different, for there to be this many alterations and changes and corruptions in them, and for your Christian New Testament to be the inerrant Word of God. That is an absolute impossibility. And the evidence documenting these hundreds of thousands of variants is overwhelming. It is irrefutable. So the truth, the evidence is overwhelming and irrefutable that the so-called Christian New Testament isn't even remotely reliable. Now, that might be horrible news if you're a Christian. It isn't horrible news if you know Yahweh, because you don't need it. The only things that are remotely reliable in the so-called Christian New Testament is the statements of Yahusha, particularly when he is commenting on something in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, which is the vast majority of his testimony. Because you can simply go to the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms as they were revealed in Hebrew and study what was said. So his statements, when converted back to their presentation in Hebrew, as we have done with this particular realization, have value, because he is commenting on or quoting the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. But beyond that, it's almost worthless. And it doesn't need to have value, because the most insightful eyewitness accounts of what Yahusha said and did aren't found in the so-called Christian New Testament. They're found instead in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. They tell us exactly what happened, when it happened, why it happened, and how you can benefit from it. So with that point made, let's consider OIDA. Translated recognizes in the passage that I cited to you. It is the weakest of the three Greek words to know. Gnosko is stronger. Epigenosko is stronger still. So all this is conveying is that no one currently sees, no one pays attention to, no one perceives, no one notices, no one observes, remotely appreciates this specific day. The classical Greek, in classical Greek, OIDA denoted intuitive understanding and being acquainted with something theoretically. Knowledge which is based on evidence is gnosko in Greek, and complete knowledge, complete awareness, total understanding is based upon epigenosko. So all Yahusha said, and he didn't actually say this because he was reading a Hebrew passage, but once it is translated into to Greek, is that the Greek says no one recognizes the day because they're not paying attention to the evidence. Even more specifically, OIDA was written in the perfect indicative tense. Such verbs describe a completed action which occurred in the past, but which produced a resulting state which exists in the present. The perfect tense, therefore, conveys that the present state of affairs at the time this was spoken existed because of a previous condition. The indicative tense simply denotes that the condition is real. This means that the ubiquitous failure of the disciples and everyone else at the time to understand Yahusha's mission within the context of the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms had resulted in the present condition of being unable to recognize what they had previously predicted. Well, almost no one realizes when Yahusha is returning today. That is not what God said. Even the translation of the translation of the translation, by using the perfect indicative tense, which is the present tense in Hebrew, no one in Yahusha's audience at the time of his revelation recognized, appreciated, acknowledged, saw, perceived, discerned, or noticed that the predicted day was already known when he would return. This was absolutely true and is almost universally so today. Virtually no one recognizes this specific and definite, this unique and certain special day when we can approach Yahweh, because they're clueless as to what the purpose of Yom Kippurim is. They don't even think that Yom Kippurim, the day of reconciliation, applies to them. They don't even know that God gave them an invitation to come into His presence, much less what they should do in response to that invitation. Their thinking is convoluted. The evidence is there. Those who want to know can know. The reason for this is, as a rule, Christians don't study Yahusha's message in the context of the covenant promises them. They don't connect important fulfillments to the Mikre. They don't even know what the Mikre are. They don't know that He fulfilled Passover, unleavened bread, first fruits, and Shavuah on the right day, in the right order, or that He will conclude His work when He returns on Yom Kippurim, the day of reconciliation. They don't associate His work with Yahweh's promises. And not one in a thousand connects the parallel passages in Zechariah to Matthew. Zechariah to Matanyahu. Remember Yah to the gift of Yah. So Christians don't recognize what's going to happen or when. And most Jews, secular humanists, atheists, Muslims, Hindus, and Buddhists have no interest in this subject. Now the fourth option, Larry, relative to understanding this passage, is tied to the fact that Yahusha quickly transitioned in the Olivet Discourse to a discussion regarding the Teruah harvest. This is something you brought up in the last segment. Well, the day and the year this ingathering will occur is the day of the year, I should say, is known to those of us who study the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. The year it's going to occur is not known to us. And while Yahusha and Yahweh know the year, there is no way for man to discern it from Scripture. All I know for sure is that the Teruah harvest will occur on Teruah, which is often called trumpets, sometime between now and the fall of 2026. So you've got 14 more days for it to occur. 14 more Teruahs between now and the beginning of the tribulation. In this regard, Yahusha's answer, if he in fact inferred this and didn't cite the Zechariah passage, might have been ingenious. Jews have substituted the Babylonian Rosh Hashanah, which means head of the year, for Yahweh's Teruah, shout for joy and signal the warning. So rabbis called Rosh Hashanah the hidden day that no one knows, only the Father. In their warped minds, it was the one day each year when Satan accused Jews of being bad before God. So they blew their trumpets, you know, they had to have some element of truth, so the trumpet was the connection back to Teruah. So they blew their trumpets, but not to herald a warning, not to shout out the good news that God has a path and has summoned them, has invited them to meet with Him. No, they blew their trumpets to confuse the devil. And they kept the day secret so that Satan would miss his appointment with God. Therefore, by saying that he would come for his family on the day no one knows, only the Father, Yahusha could well have been telling his disciples that the harvest of saved souls would occur on Teruah, now religiously known as Rosh Hashanah. That's clever. And that's the thing that you mentioned in the last segment. Now, the fifth consideration, and there's the final one, and I think it is so obvious that this is the case that I'm surprised that that it isn't genuinely known, but it isn't generally known. I think only those who have read Yada Yah and the Introduction to God know what I'm going to share next, but we've hinted at it all through this program. The fifth consideration, and the only informed rational conclusion, for interpreting this passage as it appears in Matanyahu, is that it is the realization that everything Yahusha had said up to this point, and would say after this point, had been written in Zechariah about him and about this time. So all he was doing was citing it. The subject, the timing, the context, the words, selections are virtually identical, as they have been all the way through this Olivet Discourse, meaning that it is certain that Yahusha was answering his disciples' questions, doing the one thing that he advised everyone to do every time he was questioned, which is to cite what a prophet or the Torah had said about this particular question. God provides the answer. And he would always tell us where to look for that answer, which was the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. So he was citing a prophet that he himself had inspired. So speaking of the day that he's going to return, in Hebrew he said, it was, it is, and it always shall be, the one day whereby it was, it is, and always will be known to approach Yahweh. Now, moving to Aramaic and then Greek and Latin and English, word order varies between languages and is often irrelevant, as is the case with Latin, which significantly influenced our translations further. In this case, no, only, God, one, and day are all in the text of both citations, but only in a slightly different order, thereby providing an entirely different rendering, one being entirely accurate in Hebrew and utterly stupid in Greek. In Greek, the statement is so false that if it is true, Yahusha is false. And if it is true, if it is false, then the whole testimony that as it is recovered is not credible. And in the other, everything fits together perfectly and is completely consistent with all of Yahweh's testimony. So you choose. Segment of Shattering Myths today. It is interesting now that we have demonstrated that Yahweh said conclusively what day that he is going to return, that it will be the day that we are to approach him, which is Yom Kippurim. This is the next line that is revealed in Zechariah's testimony. Zechariah, of course, means remember Yahweh. Zechar can also be translated mention Yahweh. So mention Yahweh's name and remember Yahweh's name is the meaning of this book, because it is Yahweh who is returning. He says, there shall be no day and no night, and the light shall exist at that point in time of sundown. So he's speaking of the day of his return on Yom Kippurim, and he says, there'll be so no day or night, and then the light shall exist at the point of sundown. So the sundown on Yom Kippurim, first of all, there is no day and night. The reason there is no day and night at this time is that the sun and the moon are obscured. We're told that is going to be the case, and we're told that that's the case for a number of different reasons in a number of different places, one of which is this constant onslaught of storms. Another is the realization that we've had an asteroid strike. There's another consequence of a massive tsunami that is predicted, and we also have the results of the nuclear holocaust that follows the Magog War. We also have the issue of the fact that at the conclusion of the first phase of the Magog War, Yahweh himself torches the oil and gas sources throughout the Middle East to make it impossible for Muslims to continue their efforts to destroy Israel. And so there is no sun there is no night, there is no day at that time, not perceivable from us. But then it says, and then the light shall exist at the point of time of sundown. Now, you won't be able to see sundown from the earth, but that doesn't mean that sundown doesn't occur from its normal perspective. And so what God is saying is that the light is going to exist at the point in time of sundown. Means that since there's only one sunset associated with each of the Hebrew days, and therefore there's only one sunset associated with Pesach, with Matzah, with Bukurim, and therefore with Yom Kippurim, and that sunset is the one that commences the day, because the next sunset is the end of the day. And therefore, the light's going to exist at the point in time of sundown. That means all you have to do is look at the forecast sundown in Jerusalem on October 2nd in 2033, which comes out to 6:22 p.m., and you can know to the minute when Yahusha is going to return.
That's October 2nd. 2 p.m. from the perspective of Jerusalem.
That is correct. Do you know of any other perspective that Yahweh has?
No, he's returning there.
He is. Last time I checked, he told us he's returning there. Mount of Olives, right? Mount of Olives,
right.
Which
I'm just saying that's 11:22 a.m. our time.
Standard. Okay. All right. So, yeah, it's 11:22 a.m. On the American East Coast, which is 6:22 p.m. That's correct. It's not going to happen at 6:22 p.m. In any clock in America, because despite what the Christian church in America thinks, that they're the apple of God's eyes, that God's blessing America, God has no association of any kind with America. He's not coming to America. He's coming back to Jerusalem, which is the source of reconciliation on the day of reconciliation. Jerusalem means the source from which reconciliation flows, and he's coming back on the day of reconciliation. Oh, boy, I bet that's a coincidence. And therefore, if you want to know the time, look to the time in Jerusalem. Jerusalem time, 6:22 p.m., October 2nd, 2033. It is a Yobel year. It is exactly 40 Yobel since he left us. After fulfilling the first four Moed Mikre, Pesach, Matzah, Bukurim, and Shavuot, seven Sabbaths. And that is when he's going to return, on Yom Kippurim. And the date is known for certain. Now, it'll be approaching lunchtime on the American East Coast, based upon the 7-hour time zone differential. But my friends, you can know not only the day and the hour, but even right to the minute. But my hope is that all of those who listen to this program, that none of you will be there in person to witness this, although you will be there in spirit. And we'll speak about that when we return on our program tomorrow. Actually, on Monday. This is Shattering Myths.
A year ago, I began to do a lot of research into why, even though I had a pretty good-sized meal, that I was still starving. And my research led me to a well-known fact that